So, guten Abend, good evening, and welcome to our lecture series, Decentering Europe. When we, as the organizing team, discussed the program of this lecture series, we agreed that at least one or two talks should be dedicated to the southern or eastern border zones of the European Union, where, as one can assume, discussions about Europe, its frontiers, and its composition are urgent as well as controversial, and where Europeanness is negotiated in daily practices and in the context of political processes. We noticed then an article with the title Ambivalent Builders, Europeanization, the Production of Difference and Internationals in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Drawing on thick ethnographic material, the author, Kimberly Coles, points out two tensions that arise from the interactions between the numerous representatives of international organizations in Bosnia and local inhabitants. The article shows that, on the one hand, the internationals, as they call themselves, bypass the ordinary services and infrastructure of the Bosnian state and live instead in a quite separated, exclusive, supranational space, even though one of the main targets of the engagement of the international community in Bosnia is the establishment of a stable, democratic, and coherent state. On the other hand, the internationals produce in their daily conversations, for example, images about the otherness of the Bosnians compared to Europeans, arguing that Bosnians are not really Europeans or not yet Europeans, even though it is the defined and all-encompassing intention of the international community to prepare and support the entry of Bosnia-Herzegovina into the European Union. The article makes clear that what makes Bosnia specific is the fact that processes and projects of inclusion and exclusion operate simultaneously and that the objects of inclusion and exclusion are the same, the territory called Bosnia-Herzegovina and its inhabitants. I am very happy to be able to welcome this evening the author of this article, Kimberly Coles, as a contributor to our lecture series. Between 1997 and 2000, Kimberly Coles did extensive research on the project of the international community to promote democracy in Bosnia. To be more precise, she acted as a participant observer in 5 election missions in post-war Bosnia. In her publications, she analyzes this field as one constitutive example or as a laboratory for the development of systems, actors, mechanisms and techniques of global governance which have emerged since the end of the Cold War and are still in the process of emerging. In a new research project, Kimberly Coles will follow the globally circulating discourses on democracy or transparency, as well as the mobile staff of international electoral observation missions to places like Azerbaijan, Cambodia, or Fiji. In her contribution this evening, she will focus on this new project, I guess. Yeah. Kimberly Coles received her PhD in cultural anthropology from the University of California, Irvine in 2003. She worked as lecturer in social anthropology at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, and since 2006 she has held the position of assistant professor at the University of Redlands in California. Currently she is based in Salzburg, Austria, where she directs the European outpost of her university. The results of her research in Bosnia were published most of all in 2007 in her book Democratic Designs, International Intervention and Electoral Practices in Postwar Bosnia-Herzegovina. And the title of her lecture this evening is Bosnia and Beyond, Europeanization Projects and Global Circuits of Democracy Promotion. Please.
Well, first of all, of course, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm both very pleased to now be based in Salzburg, so that it made it more possible, but honored to follow in what has been a spectacular lineup of guests at your series. Mostly I will be speaking a little bit about what's happened since Bosnia, and so I hope not to disappoint too much in the professed interest of making sure that someone was speaking from the perspective of the southern or eastern margin. So Bosnia and beyond, Europeanization projects. And I'll read quite a bit of it. If I speak too fast, please let me know. In September 1998, now 12 years ago, but only 2 years after the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina, 2,625 foreigners arrived in Bosnia to supervise the internationally implemented elections. Post-war democratic elections were mandated by the 1995 peace accords, as I'm sure you know, and they were overseen by the regional European IGO, the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. So sort of as a base background, the 2,600 supervisors were recruited through foreign ministries of the OSCE member states, which include all of the countries in Europe and also the Soviet successor states and Canada and the United States, with Korea and Japan being special guests somehow of the OSCE as well. And so the foreign ministries hand them over to the OSCE, and they were given as volunteers to the election department. These supervisors acted as the agents of the international community and of democracy in ensuring that Bosnia had internationally acceptable, free, and fair elections. So what I'd like to do today as part of the Decentering Europe series is to ethnographically analyze the experience of these 2,600 while they were in Bosnia, but also profoundly their legacy in the world of international democracy promotion in the subsequent 12 years. And that legacy has been profound. Within a very short, ultimately 12 years, what was ad hoc and unique has become globally normalized, where 80% of presidential and parliamentary elections around the world are now internationally observed or supervised, where this was unusual 12 years ago. So the EU, especially, and the OSCE now regularly, consistently, and institutionally, as part of EU foreign policy, fund volunteers and paid staff to observe, supervise, and implement elections, mostly in new or new-ish democracies, although in a critical shift, and one I'll explore more later, the OSCE has started just in the past 5 years to observe in what political scientists would call consolidated democracies, like the United States or Germany. In Bosnia's case, the 4 years of war, genocide, destruction, set the stage for these tumultuous democratic and electoral performances and laid the groundwork for the presence of mass thousands of foreigners. But, however, the logics behind the arrival of observers have shifted, and this is the story. It's a European story that I'd like to trace. So election monitoring, as theorized by political scientists, contributes to the dissemination and strengthening of basic standards of electoral administration. I'm sorry, it's this part puts people to sleep. And it advances competitive and regular elections as an international norm. It discourages fraud, and it promotes participation.
Sorry, just a computer problem. Oh. In the background, don't worry about it.
Okay.
Sorry.
So one question is, what are the mechanisms that do this? What are the mechanisms that deter fraud, that encourage participation, that strengthen standards and normalize the idea of competitive elections? So one method, and I'll put a straw man up for the political scientists, a political science answer might be to detail what the election monitors do when they're observing elections or supervising elections. They set up polling booths, they enforce rules, they deliver documents, count ballots, they rectify mistakes. They can suspend voting, all of these things. Their work involves monitoring elections and promoting democracy, enacting the election. But another method of answering the question involves paying close attention to the experience of being an international election supervisor or observer. And doing so gives a more nuanced picture of this increasingly important strategy of foreign policy. But paying attention to the experience also uncovers new paradoxes and questions and problems. First, about the purported effectiveness of election monitoring. Is it actually effective? And second, showcases the other cultural work that election monitoring performs through, for example, the discursive role of Europe, on one hand, and second, the standardization of international governance practices. So, for example, ethnographic research in Bosnia evidenced that many of the international election supervisors had experiences that were at odds with the importance given to their role. More often than not, supervisors questioned their necessity, the necessity of their presence, and also the efficacy of their election monitoring, expressing jadedness about the utility of their work or offering alternative accounts altogether. So, for example, a Belgian colleague confided to me over coffee. He said, quote, "I don't really have a job here. I had one for maybe 3 of the 16 months I've been here, but mostly someone else could be doing the work or someone else is doing the work. I'm only part of a foreign policy strategy to bolster the number of internationals in country. More internationals will make the election more smooth," end quote. And here, Guy, my Belgian colleague, he references both the impulse towards impression management on the part of the international community and also the desire for free and fair elections. And he critiqued the desire to enact the election on behalf of the Bosnians. That's not sustainable. And in fact, the international community also believed it was not sustainable, but the impression management was at the time more important. So it's things like this about the efficacy of their work. Similarly, and one of the things I'll spend more time talking about, is that elections were a prime site for the deployment of European rhetoric and symbols aimed at promoting and imagining a particular Europe and a particular European, such as Jens discussed in the earlier article I wrote. And also, so I'll show you some images that, if you've read my book, you've seen them before. They're not the only images about Europe, but they're among my favorites. So, for example, this one says, it's an election poster, says, "We do not want war, we again want to be in Europe." Think of that in September. September was the day of elections. So it's these overwhelming images plastered all over Sarajevo and the rural countrysides that use Europe as a way to encourage voting and also to vote toward particular election political parties in a very subtle way, because of course no one would suggest you vote for a particular party. This is another common framework with the EU halo in this case. And this is for the election law, and it says that the way to Europe depends on you. And in this case, they were very, very keen on Bosnia passing the election law, which took them 3 years to do. The rhetorics of Europe are not always successful, but they still are always there. And then, again, paying close attention to the experiences of the supervisors, a third item that's uncovered through this attention to experiences and practices are about the dynamics and productions of transnational governance. In Bosnia, for example, in the early post-war years, 96, 97, 98, electoral supervisors embodied particular forms of democratic management and epistemology, such as transparency and accountability, the technique or the techne of democracy. So looking back, Bosnia has emerged as an early node in the professionalization and the codification of particular forms of democracy and democratic knowledge. And it's deployed through these last 12 years in service of foreign policy aims of liberal and neoliberal transformations in the name of peace and security. So given the work of elections, the cultural work of elections and transnational governance in Bosnia and its growth as a global industry in Fiji, Tajikistan, Cambodia, what I'd like to do from here is to illustrate a mingling of diverse strands of practices and meanings on the part of democracy promotion institutions, bureaucracies, and personnel. and the meanings are embedded or construed in the political and economic contexts at the turn of the millennium. Neoliberal labor markets, we were just talking about this, the sort of insecurity of consultancy type of work, of EU expansion, of course, the democratic peace proposition where democracies don't fight with other democracies and has been enshrined in EU policy, and then post-socialism. It's an analysis that I'm presenting that seeks to complicate our tendency to treat transnational governance as unified, singular, or necessarily coherent practice. And so I seek to, or the analysis seeks to uncover the aesthetics of transnational governance, its particular forms, but also its contingencies and its alliances, tensions, power dynamics. So I'd like to focus on three features that were present in Bosnia, and then consider how the three manifest themselves now in current practice. The three are, I'll reference them, double pedagogy, the internal hierarchies, and also assumptions of motivation and intentionality. Throughout all of the consideration of these three features, the vehicle is post-socialism and the dynamics of post-socialism, and how that is manifested through in the transnational governance of electoral observation. First, I'm going to do that, but I'd like to spend just a little bit of time more on electoral observation. So I stated that it's now a cornerstone of foreign policy in the EU and in Europe more broadly. The United States, which many people tend to think of as the big democracy exporter, has actually withdrawn from democracy promotion, Afghanistan and Iraq notwithstanding. And the EU has begun to brand itself as the provider of democratic services and of electoral expertise, perhaps because Iraq is such a shambles. Right. So between 2006 and 2009, the EU or the OS and the OSCE together performed 70 electoral missions, often with 200 to 400 observers each. The number of missions, that's a slide that I just like, but I didn't know where to put it in. This is the logo for the OSCE. It's one of the things that is very important throughout this is the overwhelming rhetoric on vision rather than listening or other senses, which has a lot of flaws, but I love this picture. It's also mobile eyes. These eyes have feet. Right, and mobility is also a cornerstone of the observations. Okay, so this graph here shows that the number of missions sent each year has been steadily increasing since their eruption in the mid-1990s, and then the Bosnia missions are here, just in starting in 1996. So Bosnia is in this early node of the emergence of electoral observation when it was still ad hoc and they weren't quite sure what was going to happen. Election monitoring itself began in the 1950s, but the missions were on the whole quite small and made up of high-ranking diplomats and politicians. The Nicaraguan 1990 election is a turning point, and there were also 2,500 observers in Nicaragua. Most of those early elections were UN implemented, but the EU has taken over UN ones, and with particular conflict elections such as Congo or Cambodia, the UN and the EU have memos of understanding, and so the UN often contracts the EU to do that work for them. Again, now with over 250 missions, Europe has begun to brand itself as the provider of electoral expertise. The smallest missions are called assessment missions, and they're made up of only 8 to 10 experts who spend approximately 2 weeks in a country analyzing and describing its electoral system. Assessment missions in the last 4 years had been sent to places such as Netherlands, Italy, Canada, Switzerland, Poland, and Uzbekistan. Larger electoral missions have hundreds and hundreds of short and long-term observers, and they arrive about 2 months ahead of time if you're going to be a long-term. Long-term is 2 months, and short-term is 2 weeks. And they are managed by a small set of core staff who may be there possibly maximum for 6 months. But these core staff specialize in political parties, campaigns, media, for example. Voting, electronic voting, is a new trend, of course. The size of the mission depends on multiple factors, such as finances, but also the state of democratic transition, whether or not there's an active conflict, and then, of course, the size of the country. Missions to Georgia and Belarus recently have run between 300 and 400 people. The Ukraine had 700 people. Moldova, 100 and between, it was 150. And Latvia had 18. In terms of the division, the OSCE and the EU are now the main players, but they divide up the world differently. The OSCE monitors Europe and Eurasia, and the EU has everything else. So recent EU missions have included Bangladesh, Ghana, Guinea-Bissau, Ecuador, Rwanda, Haiti, the West Bank, and Bhutan. Not all of these are necessarily needy, conflict-ridden elections. But they, too, field between 150 and 500 observers. So now moving on to Europe and electoral provision and this provision. This rise in democratic services by Europe parallels, of course, the transformations in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And the discourses of the East-West divide are prominent and constitutive, but they're also analytically reductionist. The problem in this case is that European electoral expert community has always included, from the very beginning, Central and Eastern Europeans and Central Asians from the USSR. So from the very beginning, it was always more complicated than just the West promoting its values. And so one of my analytical concerns has been about nesting Orientalisms, to use Bukowski's term, the process through which the other is defined, and how the other defines itself and other others, with particular attention to how post-socialist electoral monitors engage these processes externally and internally. So how they otherize, as it were, but also how they respond to the liberal otherizing of the election circuit, where they have been historically and socially subjugated as well. So, and this is what I mean by a double democratic pedagogy. The presence of post-socialist democratizers in democracy promotion in Bosnia, for example, was as important for those promoting democracy as those hosting the intervention, if that makes sense. So the Polish, we were talking about Poles earlier, the Polish supervisors that came to Bosnia to supervise the election were both supervising the Bosnians and also being subject to democratizing impulses within the international aid community. So there are double projects going on at the same time. The transnational governance of electoral observation is not simply a forceful imposition of Western values onto receiving states, but it's a site where Europe and European is formed and negotiated and made obvious to itself as well as to others. There is a Europeanization, but it's not necessarily a steamroller process saying this is what Europeans will be, but rather an articulation and a constant arrangement of figuring it out within the European community as well. So the international, let me scoot back. The international interventions in Bosnia were explicitly positivist and progressivist. The transformations, the Dayton peace agreements, are thought of by everybody as blueprints that would lead to a better Bosnia-Herzegovina. And this blueprint rhetoric amply demonstrates which ends were desired, primarily the development of liberal and neoliberal institutions and subjects, with the creation of a central bank, public corporations, democratic elections, human rights enforcement, and of course, the privatization of property. And then the healing of social life after the war. So post-conflict was a dominant frame for the international interventions, but liberal and neoliberal transitions were the organizing devices, even for post-conflict. The one way forward out of the conflict is liberal peace and democracy. So given that the end of the war and post-socialism in the early 1990s, we shouldn't be surprised that post-socialist observers were caught up in the double binds as they too navigated power relations structured by the transition rhetorics. I'd like to just detail a couple of characters, use character sketches and some scenarios to ground things. And, of course, they're composite people often and pseudonyms and changing identifying features so as to protect anyone's anonymity. The character sketches, for me, are an important device, even though they're not necessarily exactly real, because of, again, the tendency to paint the international community as this block, and this unified block. And so paying attention to individual experiences is a way to emphasize the social community is not a community and is made up of real people. And the experience of Bosnians with the international community is as variable as any individual's experience within this larger structure. So first, the Piotr and the Polish supervisors. There were 230 Polish supervisors in 1998 as a part of the 2600. They took a bus from Warsaw, traveling for over 24 hours before they reached Zagreb, which was used as the intake city for Bosnia-bound observers. They weren't the only supervisors who had made long trips, but theirs was the longest and certainly the most confined. They arrived in, 50-seat buses, so there were several buses, right? The point is, in fact, that every other, the French and the German and your typical Western European all arrived by plane, and all of the Eastern Europeans arrived by bus or train. And on one hand, they're closer, but for the most part, this is financial. The point being, it could be on the surface that Poland didn't have a lot of money, so they didn't want to spend a lot of money and couldn't spend a lot of money to get their supervisors to Bosnia. But in fact, the Polish government didn't spend any money because the Americans paid for all of the Eastern Europeans that year as part of the democracy promotion agenda of the United States. And again, it's the double pedagogy, right? The American resource contributions were directed toward Bosnians, certainly, but also toward other democratizing countries. And so all of, this is just an easy example, but much of the electoral supervision contained this double pedagogical impulse. Peter was funded to come to Bosnia so that he could help Bosnians master democratic subjectivity, but he was expected to also learn to master it through acting as the verification device. This long bus trip, unfortunately, affected their ability to stay awake during the training exercises over the next 3 days, which were given at eight-hour stretches with coffee and smoking breaks and in English. More often than not, in comparison, the Eastern European supervisors had weaker English skills, and that made it harder for them to comprehend the eight-hour-long lessons and secondly, pay attention over that length of time, despite ultimately what were quite good exercises and particularly hands-on for a class. But these very mundane interactions had the effect of reinforcing their underpreparedness and their relative lack of and the perception of their relative lack of knowledge compared to people who had better English skills and who had arrived in a little cushy flight from Paris. So as stereotype. And this leads me to a second character sketch that of other supervisors, like a woman, Sophie, from Lithuania, and a group of anonymous Bulgarian supervisors. The internationals in Bosnia, these electoral supervisors, feel quite multicultural and cosmopolitan, and they want to be multicultural and cosmopolitan and post-national. They commonly, in interviews, reference the multinational makeup of their work and their social environments as the main reason they like their jobs, saying that they enjoy working with so many different types of people. In most, but not all, cases, this is explicitly not about Bosnians, in the case of Bosnia, but again about the working environment of being in this European post-national world. However, paradoxically, a strong nation-state hierarchy existed within the international community. For example, an international of Western European heritage might comment on the incompetence and uselessness of UN personnel from third world countries. The Eastern Europeans also in the early, late 90s got a raw deal, particularly your two new entries to the EU, Bulgaria and Romania. Long-term electoral staff would often sigh deeply about getting so many Bulgarians and Romanians. They would complain to me, as the outsider, this is, quote, "Can't they be distributed around the country more evenly?" The response to this rhetorical placement on the bottom rung of the ladder, as unfortunate as it is, was primarily reflected in practices of insecurity on the part of the Bulgarians and Romanians. So, for example, in a desperate attempt to blacklist a particular Bulgarian supervisor, a group of his colleagues, other Bulgarians, forged a letter to their ministry from the supervision office at the OSCE, saying that he was horrible and not welcome back due to his misconduct and ineptitude. The supervision office learned of this when the foreign office in Bulgaria called and asked them for verification of this letter. They could not verify the letter, but it was true that the supervisor was widely considered incompetent and a menace. It was supervisors like him, you know, the bad apples, as people would talk about, which became representative of the Bulgarian group. And his fellow Bulgarians felt that interpolation, felt that recognition, and tried to resist it as best they could. Supervisors also complained loudly amongst themselves about supervisors they felt were not serious, either in Bosnia for the money or for, quote, adventure tourism. And there was vocal disdain for electoral tourists for the latter, it was, again, people who didn't take the job seriously or were only in it for the money. For the latter, the phrase uttered was most often, "It's a volunteer position, you shouldn't be doing it for the money." And this, for the most part, was also directed at Eastern Europeans, who did not participate in the dominant consumption lifestyle of these supervisors who are out of their normal routine for 2 weeks and given large amounts of cash. So, for example, Hane was a graduate student in sociology from the Czech Republic. Like Sophie, who I just skipped over in my notes, she lived frugally while she was in Bosnia. Her lodging had been prearranged, and so she had to pay for her lodging. But she chose to cook in the apartment rather than going out, and she had actually brought food with her from Prague rather than going to the grocery stores in Bosnia. She's a rather extreme example in that she spent no money. I was her roommate, and she spent no money. But most Eastern Europeans, again in 1998, were saving money for sustenance and livelihood as they could, because they were receiving $90 a day paid out in Deutschmark. Right? And so for two... for 2 weeks, that's over $1,000, which went, in fact, a long way in California, let alone in any of the Eastern European countries. Canadians and Americans and French and Spanish were also saving money because it was hard to spend $90 every day in Bosnia. Flush with money, supervisors paid their rent, they ate at restaurants, they sat in coffee shops, they bought a lot of bootleg CDs. It was very easy to experiment with unknown musical genres and to try and round out your musical collection. They spent at very, very high rates, and so this is the public persona of the international supervisor. And many supervisors tried to limit their spending. But for the most part, the Western, to use these horrible categories, the Western Europeans and Americans were saving for luxury. So, for example, a friend, a colleague friend, an American, had dedicated some of the funds for a mountain bike purchase that he wanted. And so he said, well, my mountain bike is $800, and this is an easy way of getting it. Or another... Deborah was using the money to travel to Spain so she could have a vacation after the trip. They were also saving, but the money was differently allocated than the post-socialist supervisors. And one way to think through this is simply, again, about in pure economics, is using GDP and the purchasing power parity, the PPP measure from 1998. The $1,000 that Hanna was saved accounted for 11% of the Czech GDP per capita versus 3% for the United States, right? Bulgaria's purchasing power, if Bosnia is a 1, standardized against Bosnia at 1, was 1.4 for Bulgaria, 1.6 for Romania, and Netherlands is at 7, and the United States at 8. Right. So the money differentials seem trivial, but in fact, Poland and Bulgaria had more in common in purchasing power with Bosnia in terms of standards and cost of living at the time than any of the three of them did with Canada, the United States, or Spain. So these financial differentials help contextualize the tensions and hierarchies within the international aid community in this type, in the elections, over motivation, intentionality of why people are there or what they're getting out of it, and pinpoints powerful relational assumptions within concepts like volunteerism or humanitarianism. What does it? What's the price? Who can be a humanitarian aid worker? So the experiences of post-socialist supervisors demonstrate the clear need to adequately account for variance within the international community, even as they play out within the transition-promoting entities. In the subsequent 12 years, shifts in each of these logics have occurred in terms of the internal hierarchies, in terms of the double pedagogy, and also in terms of this sort of idea of the intention and the motivations. In post-war Bosnia, the pedagogical impulse was ubiquitous. And as I mentioned, evidence of this pedagogy exists in the financial records as well as in everyday interactions. This still goes on in slightly different terms. So evidence suggests from this new project that I'm doing that at least some of the time, post-social observers are on training missions. So in the last American elections, there were observers sent from the OSCE, and a fifth of the mission's observers, 20%, were from Kazakhstan. The Americans don't care. They don't even know they have observers. Kazakhstan sent a lot of observers to the United States, and Russia also sent disproportionately high numbers compared with their normal contributions to any countries. So the rationale in within the international, within the electoral community, as it were, was that Kazakhstan wanted the next OSCE rotating presidency, and so that they needed more skilled functionaries to do a little bit of training to get some more multinational work experience. This example is actually more direct than, more strategic than to most of the pedagogy that I'm alluding to, but the essence is similar, as is the potential impact on hierarchies. So on the reason I know about so many of the Kazakh observers was because I had a very close contact who is French and was stationed in Kansas, which is funny. And she, the French, she was partnered with a Kazakh. And in the interview I had with her, she said that her Kazakh partner had been, quote, a good driver. So it's not necessarily clear yet if there's quantitative evidence that observation missions in established democracies have higher numbers of post-socialist internationals. But there do appear to be missions that are selected by governments, particularly post-socialist ones, as particularly meaningful or strategic as trying to create a place in this new Europe and to try to position themselves strategically for the European community and their status within it. So the U.S. election mission was seen opportunistically by Russia and Kazakhstan, but the Cambodian mission in 2008 also saw higher percentages of post-socialist participation than a random selection would have suggested. And Polish interviews I did in Poland two summers ago, reported that Poland was trying to make a mark for itself as a focal point for the East, Far East in this case, and more often than not, more about Ukraine. But the Polish observers, were very clear that their foreign ministry was very strategic in how, where and when they would send Poland, so that in the impression management that Poland was engaged in. The on-the-ground context is complicated, for we also see very different demographics within... Oh, I've forgotten a slide. Two slides. Sorry. This is a picture of how ubiquitous electoral observation has come. And it's not actually very good because, of course, the Soviet Union takes up so much. Oh. The green and the yellow look the same on the screen. But...
In Antarctica, there are quite a few.
Yes, exactly. There's a lot going on where there's no... The penguins. So most of these African countries are here are yellow, but this is all... The yellow is zero, some of the of these ones. But all of these here, except for Germany, is the green, 6 to 12. Germany is alone... in the EU with not having observership, which may be interesting for someone else to take up about what that says. Here's a close-up of Europe, also with the poor yellow and green. Sort of ruins the slide, doesn't it? Okay. Anyway, what I was going to say, to get back to my point... I'm not ready. The on-the-ground context is complicated, for we see remarkably different demographics within the electoral observers. And it's clear in a country-by-country comparison that post-socialist countries have smaller pools of electoral workers, and that those smaller number of people go on mission more often. So the Eastern Europeans who do observe are more experienced. They are more likely, both quantitatively and through interviews, to be career-oriented within, to be wanting to make election observation a career versus volunteering, which had been, until recently, the dominant rhetoric of, yes, this is something fun to do, but it's something that you do on your holiday, or maybe youth do it or retirees. It presents itself, this difference presents itself in age demographics as well. Eastern European observers report that they're often decades younger than the experienced Western Europeans, who are often retirees or middle-aged workers taking vacation. So this slide, I've never before shown a scatter plot in anthropology, but it's a scatter plot of the average number of assignments that observers average number of assignments in a two-year time period between 2006 and 2008. All countries have observers who do it occasionally versus those who try and do it as often as possible. And the scatter plot, which I'll explain in a moment, also flattens out problematically the difference between a long-term two-month position and a short-term two-week position. Temporally, that's problematic. But nonetheless, the final numbers are productive. On the x-axis, the bottom axis, is the number of observer positions that a country fills. So, for example, in 2 years, this top number here is Uzbekistan. They had not very many times were there Uzbeks on the mission, but it was filled by the same person every time. Whereas here in Germany, we have many, many, many Germans on the in the slots, but that ultimately you only get one in a bit every time, so that it's not possible to be a career in Germany for the most part, either through recruitment strategies or other things going on. So every dot here, and I can point them out. I couldn't figure out how to get labeling on. It's Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, who are the top two numbers. They're sending very few, and this is in the geopolitics of the world, not necessarily surprising. Above three is Bosnia, Bulgaria, Macedonia, Serbia, and Slovakia. So also on the edge, and also not in the EU yet. So the numbers here between two and three are perhaps the most interesting. Those scatter dots between two assignments a year and three are Albania, Armenia, Georgia, Greece, Kyrgyzstan, Malta, Moldova, Poland, and Portugal. Besides Portugal and then the new and Greece, most of the purportedly core European EU countries are essentially doing it more as volunteer-based work rather than career-oriented work. Within that, the professionalization, the career-orientedness of it, is actually perhaps changing. The EU has implemented vast assessment programs and evaluation programs and training programs trying to improve the quality and the seriousness of electoral observers. And this is not generally something that corporations or governments will do for volunteers. Normally, the investment that you would put into someone is career-based, yet we see, again, relatively recently, that no one is doing more than two a year in France. So why spend all this money on them? So that's something I'd like to look at. It's suggested that the volunteer days of electoral observation are over. However, at exactly the same time, and these are the sort of dynamics, and maybe sort of trying to figure out what will be articulated what Europe should be or could be, is that the OSCE is sticking to its ideology that electoral observation is based on transparency and should be open to all, that an election is only transparent if it's transparent to an untrained observer. Little training should be required. So we have two very different forces at work, and it's not clear at all which will win, although my hypothesis is the professionalization. And this professionalization, or sort of the aesthetics of behavior, of comportment, conforms or is verified by interviews with Polish observers who have talked at length about the shift, the long-term observers, how they've noticed shifts in how they're treated in electoral missions. They reported earlier that they tended to be teamed up with Western Europeans, and they remarked how frustrating the experience of being the inferior or secondary observer had been. However, they recognized that more recently, in the last five, I won't put a time on it, there was a tendency to team post-socialist observers together. They took this, the Polish interviewees, took this as a sign of their development and an advancement, a coming of age of their Europeanness. They also took it, importantly for me, as signaling a shift toward what a post-socialist observer team could offer. They argued that post-socialist observers often worked better together because of their common background, and that they could offer, that together they offered a, quote, look what we've gone through, we've succeeded, you can too. It was an experiential camaraderie to local election staff, and they compared this to the prior dominant rhetoric of we are here to teach you how to be democratic, right? So the Polish supervisors that I've spoken with felt more of a sort of horizontal kinship with local electoral communities and felt that they had more to offer than the stereotypical Western European and American democratic hubris. And they felt that this was recognized on part of the electoral administration because that team, the deployment of teams of a Czech and a whoever, pick your Eastern European country, continued, that it was not random, that there was a certain logic previously of consolidated democracy and new democracy to this new teamwork that could be have less hubris. This sense of the changes that Eastern Europeans have brought to governance regimes parallels perhaps the most important find, the discovery that I've made, in terms of the shifts caused by or precipitated through the presence of Eastern Europeans and post-socialists. There is now a prevalent rhetoric of, quote, we can all learn together, we can all learn from each other. And practices have begun realigning themselves through a network-based governance regime, less hierarchical or differently hierarchical. It's manifested itself in, for example, the OSCE now observing and assessing in consolidated democracies. So making a financial push to say, no, we are going to observe in France, we are going to observe in Scotland, Ireland, etc. The US, Canada, Netherlands, everyone should be subject to observation and assessment because we can all learn from each other and learn through each other's challenges and responses. This is actually has a whole other surveillance realm to it, but it's been precipitated by the Eastern Europeans' presence in this community. Similarly, the EU is part of a larger consortium of democracy promotion actors who now function almost solely within the rhetoric of best practices, so sharing best practices between them. Mexico, although Mexico's 2006 elections were, I'm sure you know, shambles, the IFE, Mexico's national authority, is widely respected and consults internationally on electoral technologies. So both the OSCE and the EU are shifting towards ubiquitous external monitoring of everyone always all together, which has, again, as I alluded, its own scary nature to it. The election administrations are also at pains to respond forcefully to the Western imperialism critique, which is easy to make. There have been explicit attempts to diversify the electoral personnel and expand the necessity of monitoring, again, to everyone rather than just needy countries. the OSCE has actually also put together a fund which will fund less wealthy countries such as Tajikistan and Uzbekistan to encourage more of those monitors. So they're trying to have a public face that's quite diverse. What time do I end? Soon. Oh. Unlike many of those that we work with in anthropology, the international observers in my circle of informants and colleagues are not dispossessed or failing to reap the rewards of late capitalism. These post-socialist observers, these post-socialist internationals, are among those who are proactively becoming everything Europe wants them to become. Some succeed, some fail, however, within the politics of interpolation. On the surface, this poor Kazakh driver might try again, right, to gain the trust of a partner and the respect on electoral mission. And at the other end of the spectrum is a Latvian colleague who has a PhD in anthropology from Cambridge. She's been on three different missions, and she's not trying to make a career move of it. She has a job as a lecturer and an appointment in her foreign service. But she likes to travel, and it's something different to do, something different from her regular pace. She's in a position to laugh at the uptightness of other observers who complain when they don't get good marks on their assessment, right? So the EU has put in this assessment mechanism. She realizes that a perfect assessment, a perfect score, assists in future assignments, and that people are trying to make a career move with this. But she cringes at the career strategizing of her colleagues. Ines, is what a scholar, Adrian Favel, has called a Eurostar, or a free mover. She aspires to take advantage of the dynamic mobility policies and feel post-national, but she has the job security to be post-national. So these wide experiences of post-socialist observers demonstrate the need to adequately account for variance within the transnational governance communities, and they shed light on the experiences of transitions. The members of the international community here are the bodily, the corporeal techne that pushes the political out of elections and makes it about the candidates or about the political parties. But anthropology has a duty. Anthropology must continue to insist that the technical and bureaucracy are places for critical cultural analysis, because doing so uncovers the sort of contestations and shifts and fluidity, the power dynamics within very dry material. And we can see it as a political laboratory of global election observation. And thinking about it as a lab, as a laboratory, you can see the reconfigurations of Europe taking place, sort of, and the strategizing, the positioning of what Europe will be and what it should be. Thank you.